Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Women's Podcast. I'm Roisin Ingle, and we want to wish you all a belated St. Bridget's Day. And we're all looking forward to our new bank holiday in honour of our matron saint, Bridget, or goddess saint, or whatever you're having yourself. She was some woman for one woman. And I think it's amazing that we're all celebrating her and marking her, because it does make a bit of a change. So to celebrate both of those things, Bridget's Day yesterday and also the bank holiday on Monday, we're going to be looking back and remembering some bad Bridgets.
In New York in 1862, there were more than 14,000 Irish women in prison, which represented 86% of the prison population. And even more striking was there were, in the same year, there were just over 11,000 Irish men in prison. So actually, Irish women are outnumbering Irish men, which is extremely unusual in criminal statistics.
That was Elaine Farrell there, one of the authors of the new book, Bad Bridget. But before we come to them, I wanted to let you know about something that former X-Files star Gillian Anderson is doing. You might know that she also stars in Sex Education on Netflix, and it got her thinking about female sexual fantasies. So she wrote an article in The Guardian the other day, and she's basically asking women to write into her, telling her all about their sexual fantasies. She wrote, "Since Sex Education was broadcast, friends and journalists started asking me if women sometimes felt compelled to share their sexual problems or fantasies with me. Well, they don't, which ultimately is what gave me the idea for a book that would be revelatory and profound and inclusive across the board. I want women across the world, and all of you who identify intrinsically as women now, queer, heterosexual and bisexual, non-binary, transgender, polyamorous, all of you, young and old, whatever your religion and married, single or other, to write to me and tell me what you think about when you think about sex, whether it's when you're having it by yourself or with a partner or with more than one. Tell me. Let's create an era-defining text that cuts right to the heart of what it is to be a woman today, a book that will hopefully inspire women for generations to come. For now, let's just call it Dear Gillian. It will be published by Bloomsbury Publishing, and we've set up a secure email address to receive your submissions. All identities will be protected and your submissions will be treated as anonymous. I will, of course, be including my own letter anonymously. I look forward to reading yours." So that is Gillian Anderson. She wants to know what you think about when you think about sex. And you can submit your fantasies at deargillian.com until midnight, 28th of February. So that's deargillian.com until midnight, 28th of February. So there you go. If you fancy sending your sexual fantasies to Gillian Anderson, go for it. The book certainly sounds like it's going to be very, very interesting. Now, today, we are revisiting a conversation from a couple of years ago. We spoke back then to historians Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack about their podcast, Bad Bridget, which I'm delighted to say has now been turned into a book. It's called Bad Bridget: Crime, Mayhem and the Lives of Irish Emigrant Women. As you know, Ireland in the 19th and early 20th centuries was not a good place to be a woman. Among the wave of emigrants from Ireland to North America were many, many young women who travelled on their own, hoping for a better life. Some of them led lives of quiet industry and piety, and others quickly found themselves in trouble, bad trouble, on a quite astonishing scale. Elaine and Leanne talked to me about their podcast back then, but it's all in the book too. In 5 years of research, they've uncovered a world where Irish women outnumbered Irish men in prison, where you could get locked up for a crime of stubbornness. I think a lot of us would be in prison if that was still the case. And where a serial killer called Lizzie Halliday was described by the New York Times as the worst woman on earth. They talked to me about the social forces that resulted in this mayhem and dysfunction. The women were often impoverished and uneducated. The stories are grim, moving, shocking, and even sometimes funny. From sex workers and thieves to kidnappers and killers, these are the bad Bridgets who for too long have been left out of the Irish immigrant story. Not anymore. We hope you enjoy listening back to this chat with Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack. I began by asking them how it all started and how they came up with the bad Bridget idea.
Well, we had been sort of using the term bad Bridget for the project kind of informally. Bridget being a really popular name for Irish women in the 19th century and Biddy being used in a sort of derogatory way for Irish women servants in America. So we'd sort of been, you know, sort of really in a kind of joking way saying, oh yeah, it's sort of all our bad Bridgets. But then we began to think, you know, maybe this actually would be a good name for the project, and it would really, you know, it would tell very quickly what the project was about. And there we were, and we then thought, hang on, we'll just do a quick Google to check that it was nobody's porn name. And it wasn't. But of course we were on university computers that were all firewalled, and I don't know why we thought that would all be, you know, it would show up anyway. But Bad Bridget it became. And I think it's been a really good name for sort of selling telling people what the project's about.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent name. And then, Elaine, so that's the name, and it's all very well having a working title and deciding on what you're going to call it. But tell us more about what was behind it, how you both came together to be so interested in these women that were sort of, I suppose, in the shadows. Very much when we think of Irish people going abroad in the diaspora, we're looking for these people who've achieved things and who made a mark and who sort of contributed to American society. And these women are, I suppose, the complete opposite of that. So what intrigued you both about that whole world?
Yeah, I suppose our aim was to try to explore the lived realities for these Irish girls and women who had migrated to the US and Canada across the 19th and the 20th century. And I suppose looking at how and why they found themselves in court or under arrest or suspected of criminal or deviant activity. And Leanne and I had independently been looking at Irish women in the US. So Leanne had been looking in New York and I had been looking in Boston, and we decided to join forces and we applied for funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council, which we secured. And so then we had the funding to be able to do a much larger project. So it was across 5 years, trawling through records in archives across New York, Boston and Toronto.
OK, well, listen, let's talk about New York first, because some of the statistics that you uncovered about women, the women prison population, were fascinating. I mean, it was quite astounding, really, and really surprising.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we were completely overwhelmed by the figures. We knew that there were going to be large numbers of Irish women there. We assumed because large numbers of Irish women migrated, but we weren't expecting the sheer volume of cases that we found. And I went over to Boston. I was over for 4 weeks, and it was like, I'm just not going to be able to collect every single case. There was just so many. So it was really, really overwhelming. But we have, you know, statistics like Irish women representing 60% of the prison population in the 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. So it means they outnumber every single other nationality combined. And, you know, you mentioned New York, Roisin, and in New York, Leanne found in 1862 that there were more than 14,000 Irish women in prison, which represented 86% of the prison population. And even more striking was there were, in the same year, there were just over 11,000 Irish men in prison. So actually, Irish women are outnumbering Irish men, which is extremely unusual in criminal statistics.
Leanne, can you paint a picture for us about the kind of Ireland these women were leaving in the 19th century and the early 20th century?
Yeah, so, I mean, this will obviously sort of changes over time as we move into the 20th century, but particularly for the women in the early decades of our research, they're leaving behind generally really poverty-stricken conditions. They're emigrating either in the middle or in the aftermath of the famine, and often that poverty is what's prompting them to migrate. Their families need them to go. They're seen as a good financial bet and a financial source of income. And these women are expected, you know, very young women expected to travel often on their own to North America to get a job and to be able to send money back and potentially then for other family members to be able to emigrate as well. And obviously women of all socioeconomic classes are migrating, but you know, the bad bridges that we come across most often and the ones that we see getting into trouble are very often coming from often quite poverty-stricken situations back in Ireland.
I suppose there's also limited job opportunities for women in Ireland. So for some, they're looking for that employment that they can secure abroad. And Irish women's, Irish girls' education is also quite patchy. And we can see this coming up in some of the prison records where they have to describe what their education is like. And, you know, they're saying that, you know, they couldn't go to school because they needed to help on the family farm, or there was a bereavement in the family, their mother perhaps, and they had to raise the younger siblings. We have one example, Maggie Brennan. She was charged with theft in 1898 when she was 20, and she describes her education, and she said she had a little bit of schooling up to the age of 10, but then she left completely. She got married at the age of 15. Within a year, she was pregnant and her husband had died. So she left her baby with her mother in Ireland, and she migrated to the US. And she said that it was there that she kind of learned to keep bad company and learned to drink. But we can just see the kind of the young age of these girls going over and the kind of lives that they had left behind.
Yeah. And Leanne, so what is it? I mean, in a general sense, we'll get into more some of the specific characters that you describe in your podcast, which is brilliant, by the way. But what were the bad things that this 86% of the female population, for example, in New York were Irish? It's just an incredible figure. What were they doing? What were they getting up to? And what were the crimes that was landing them in prison?
I mean, we see the whole range of crimes, really. But I suppose the biggest sort of area and the biggest kind of type of crime that we do see Irish women committing is generally related to alcohol. And that comes through very clearly in the records. So it might have been being drunk. It might have been being drunk and disorderly. It also often disorderly conduct was put down, and that could refer to being involved in some type of sex work as well. It was a sort of catch-all term too, but it's comes through very clearly, the impact and the influence of alcohol on a lot of crimes too. And as well as that, we have, you know, women for theft, for pickpocketing, for other kinds of theft, and then right through to women for violent crimes, for assault and for murder as well.
It's a five-part project, your podcast. So you actually have one of your episodes is just called, I think, Drunkards or Drunk or something like that. What did you find out when you were exploring the kind of how much alcohol played a part in these women's lives, and what were they doing?
I mean, I think what's very striking and what came through and some of the great newspaper reports on this as well were often these large groups of women, of Irish women, drinking together and drinking on the street. And we found some great ones for Toronto. And I think probably they had some kind of great court reporter there with who is these really, really, you know, vivid descriptions and talks about, you know, the what the women were doing, how there's, you know, there's one woman describing telling everybody what's for lunch whenever you go into jail, and very much the kind of how they really just do not care that they're there. And one of the very interesting groups we saw was this sort of intergenerational drinking. So there's a woman in her 80s, you know, there's some women maybe in their 50s and 60s, right down to kind of women in their early 20s. And, you know, that sort of paints a picture of these women all together, on the streets and often outside because their housing conditions aren't great, or also to do with the if it's warm, where the weather is very warm, they're all outside. And when they're outside, they're probably making a lot of noise. They're making a nuisance of themselves. They mightn't be doing anything actually criminal as such, but their presence on the street is often enough for them to be arrested and to be brought in. And they're easy arrests as well. You know, you can scoop up this sort of group of women and bring them in too. But what that did often show us and sort of say that for probably some of these women, they may not have had permanent addresses. They may have been homeless. They may have been vagrancy was also another common crime that women were arrested for. So, you know, in these big groups of women, while alcohol is very involved, it does tell us a lot about probably the very poor living conditions that a lot of them were under as well.
And Elaine, Leanne sort of mentioned it there a little bit. Sex work features largely in terms of, the percentage of Irish women who are involved in it. Tell us a little bit about that, what you uncovered when you started to dig into that.
Yeah, I suppose the initial research that had been done, you know, in the 1980s, early 1990s had been, you know, Irish women are very chaste and moral in Ireland and elsewhere and not really all that involved in sex work. But I suppose if you're looking at particular records, you can see that there are large numbers of Irish women who are engaged in sex work. And I suppose there's a flexibility to the job as that might have attracted some individuals. Of course, it pays, you know, for some it's paying quite well, depending on what end of the kind of spectrum that people are working in. And it's also what we can see in Ireland as well as in the US is that it's also seasonal. So women are kind of moving into sex work and then moving out of it when they have other employment. And for some, you know, domestic service was the biggest employer of Irish women in the US. But at the same time, for some, that just wasn't suitable, that, you know, that they some women express their kind of dissatisfaction with that post where somebody is kind of monitoring their behavior all the time, and maybe they're not they're not having enough savings, and maybe they're not having they can't dictate their own hours. And for women who had children as well, domestic service would have been a very difficult position. So we see a lot of Irish women popping up in sex work. Some, you know, Leanne has mentioned the women who we can kind of see who are homeless because they're coming in and out of different institutions at different points. So definitely there's some women working in that category. But we have other women who are working in quite lavish situations, you know, in boarding houses and clearly doing quite well for themselves working as escorts.
And keeping brothels as well, because there was also people in charge of other women and making a business out of it.
Yeah, there was a concern at the time that Irish girls were being duped into sex work. You know, that they were being convinced at the port that this person who had met them was going to take them to a really good domestic service position and instead was moving them into a brothel. And we do have those kind of examples, but we can also see that there's Irish women running those kind of systems, you know, that they're using their Irishness as a way to kind of convince girls to come and join them, that they're good people and they'll look out for them. So yeah, we have Irish women, you know, heading those kind of systems as well.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's really interesting what you said about the ideal or the stereotype of the Irish woman, the kind of chaste and virtuous, especially coming from, you know, say pious Ireland's land of saints and scholars and all of that. And whatever you think, I mean, obviously some of the things they were doing are very, very bad and criminal and wrong. But there was an ingenuity as well and an enterprising nature there that was going on that isn't often kind of thought of when you think of, say, Irish women who went away at that time. Did you find yourself kind of looking and in any kind of admiring way at these women, even though obviously there was a lot of criminality?
Yeah, I mean, some of the stories are funny. You know, you can really see the characters coming out. They're given a socks in the court. They're not going to let anybody criticize them. You know, the judge will say something and they're right back at them straight away. So we do see a lot of those kind of characters, which are definitely like a kind of a relief to looking at the really sad and often quite depressing stories. But I think you're completely right, Roisin. We really need to see Irish women's agency in many of these crimes. You know, we have women who are making calculated decisions to engage in criminal or deviant activity. And I don't think we should allow that kind of, oh, you know, they were poor and we feel sorry for them. We shouldn't allow that to kind of overshadow their own agency in the whole process.
And yet, of course, as you said, there are some really, really sad stories and stories born of absolute terrible life circumstances. And one of them particularly I was looking at was about Rosie Quinn. Leanne, can you tell us about her? She was only 19 and then she was sentenced to life in prison. It's a really sad story.
Yeah, it is. It is a really sad story. And it's sort of one of the stories where we hear a little bit more about her because there is a campaign to get her pardoned for her crime, because ordinarily without that, we probably wouldn't know very much about her. She would just be sort of a name on the page. But she was found guilty of throwing her newborn baby into the lake in Central Park. She's working in a hotel. And it's really from the people that she works with in the hotel and what seem to be some of the guests actually in the hotel who are essentially saying she was, you know, she's an innocent Irish girl. She was taken advantage of by this man who has sort of duped her. And that's very much the impression in the letters that's given about her, is that she's this, you know, innocent migrant. You know, she knows very little, nearly the sort of the verging on the sort of ignorant Irish girl, that she doesn't, you know, that's where the sympathy is coming from, her sort of God lover. You know, she knew no better. She was taken advantage of. She got pregnant. And then her story is that she tried to get some help. She tried to get into a home. She tried to find somewhere to stay, and they sent her away, and there was nowhere to go. And that this was the situation, that she sort of didn't mean to do it, that it was an accident. So there are these kind of issues that she's saying are kind of, that didn't happen, but it didn't sort of cut any ice in the trial. And it's really afterwards where people are beginning to write letters, and actually just people of the general public too are writing into the governor to say, this, my heart is broken, you know, hearing about this is just so tragic, and you know, please pardon her. And she is pardoned and she is released. But it just sort of shows as well that you know, about this young woman, her experience is she's pregnant, she's got no support network, she's got nowhere to go, she doesn't know what to do, and that this was her at the very, very, you know, end. She seemed to have exhausted any possibilities of finding help.
But it is also really amazing, even at that time, that people in New York who probably didn't have any connection with her or anything were taken by this story and knew that a woman driven to do something as awful as that, as throw a baby in the lake in Central Park, that she would have been that, you know, not in her right mind essentially, or had, I'd be so desperate and so worried. And it's great to see that people came to her aid and she did get pardoned. Elaine, what do you feel about Rosie's story?
I think we can really, through Rosie's story, we can really see the sympathy attached to women who kind of found themselves in this predicament. So pregnant outside marriage, and there is that kind of understanding that there would be stigma and shame attached to that. So there's nearly like a sympathy with women who then try to not be pregnant. So whether it's through infant murder, as in Rosie Quinn's case. And I think that sympathy can really show us there's the sympathy because, of course, the father of that baby is nowhere to be seen. And there was such a stigma attached to giving birth outside marriage in Ireland. And, you know, we can see from the recent reports as well, the commission and the Northern Irish report that Leanne authored with a colleague of mine, Sean O'Connell. And, you know, we can really see that stigma is lasting. You know, it's in the 19th century, but it lasts right up into the later 20th century as well. And that stigma can really affect families. You know, it's the woman's reputation, but it's also the family reputation. And so we have Irish women who are, they become pregnant in Ireland, and then they see this migration to the US as a kind of solution to that, that they can hide the fact that they have become pregnant and given birth outside marriage. And it's through those type of cases that we can see how Irish men were involved, or perhaps not even involved. You know, we have these men who are promising that, oh, I'll come over, I'll join you in the US. And then, you know, the woman ends up in an institution, and that's where we come across her, because he never arrived. I can give you one example of a woman, Ellen, who's from Galway, and she had become pregnant in Boston to an Englishman. And by the time the baby was born, he's nowhere to be seen. And she's in an institution. And then she decides she's going to go home. She's going to go back to Ireland. And she buys a passage ticket for herself and for her newborn son. And then at the last minute, she changes her mind and she just says, you know, it's going to break her mother's heart if she arrives back with the baby. So she heads off on the ship and she leaves her baby in Massachusetts, where he's put up for adoption. And, you know, it's those kind of cases that really show that stigma that was attached to giving birth outside marriage in Ireland. And then it's the same in the US as well.
That's the thing that's interesting, because, you know, we do, obviously, we've been talking so much about the mother and baby homes, and well done, Leanne, on all your reporting on that in the North as well. But the fact that there were moral reform institutions, homes for fallen women, sort of the same as we had back home, is also interesting.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, you know, sometimes we do forget that those did exist outside of Ireland, North and South. And you do see a variety of them in the cities that we looked at, run by some voluntary organisations, some run by nuns. We have the Good Shepherds in New York running a rescue home. And actually they become sort of, by the early 20th century, one of the main providers of sort of probation homes. So taking women directly from prison. The Good Shepherd home was one of the main sources where women would go and stay, operating slightly different than those in Ireland, where it would have been a shorter term and often just for the term of a sentence, and then women would have left. But you see a variety of institutions. And as Elaine said, the thing with these for unmarried mothers or for homes for women coming out of prison, there was no great sort of sympathy or necessary understanding or different attitudes often for women. And sometimes I think, you know, the women who felt maybe they were escaping the attitudes of home found exactly the same when they arrived in North America and found the same attitudes towards illegitimacy and about respectability there as well. But I suppose the benefit was that maybe you were often a bit more anonymous, and perhaps you were away from people at home who would know what had happened. But the downside of that being you don't have a support network.
It feels like that. It feels like you can imagine all these women coming to this big, bustling place, completely different environment to what they came from, where there was, you know, curtain twitching and everybody in the village knew who you were and everyone in the town. And there must have been some kind of freedom, even in the poverty and in the really dire circumstances a lot of them lived in, that they could almost reinvent themselves and do all these things because nobody knew they were the Burns from wherever, you know? Is that something you kind of got to know a bit or to understand by reading these stories?
We can see this coming up quite often for women who are working in factories, and that there's this kind of all the girls and women go socialising together after work. So we can see that kind of sense of adventure too. And you're completely right where these women and girls are leaving predominantly rural Ireland. They're arriving in big cities like Boston, New York and Toronto. Like, can you imagine the sensory shock? For many of these girls and women, they have never left their hometown before. And now they're on this ship and now they're in this new city. And in terms of the drinking as well, we have lots of reports where the women are saying, you know, alcohol is so cheap as well, and it's so easy to get. And I think there is that kind of camaraderie as well, you know, sisters going over to sisters, and there's so much more in these cities, to so many more opportunities than they would have had at home in Ireland.
The other thing from a feminist perspective about your research and what you found is that the language ascribed and the way these women are described when they do these terrible things, and there's this sense that they are doing things that are unwomanly, that are not what women are supposed to be doing. Tell us about Lizzie Halliday, because she was called the worst woman on earth. And it's a great story. So what was the story with Lizzie? Poor Lizzie.
So Lizzie is the first woman in the US to be sentenced to death by the electric chair. And she is caught for serial killing, really. So her husband disappears and her neighbours get concerned. You know, Lizzie is saying, oh, he's gone away for a few days, but the neighbours don't quite believe that story. Lizzie has a bit of a criminal record, including an arson attack. So the neighbours, when Lizzie is out of the house, the neighbours go and investigate for themselves, and they actually find the bodies, two bodies of two other neighbours. And then when the police are called, of course, and then the body of Lizzie's husband is found under the floorboards. So she's sentenced to death, but the courts find that she was instead insane, as it would have been termed at the time. And so she's instead placed in what would have been known as a lunatic asylum. And it's there that she goes on to actually kill one of the attendants. So she has quite this kind of criminal record. And you know, she doesn't match up to that idea of the pure and chaste and well-behaved Irish woman. She's presented, we had a postdoc, Leanne Calvert, who was working on the project as well. And she had found really brilliant articles showing how Lizzie is presented in this really animalistic way. You know, she's described as a tiger. Lizzie is even questioned as to whether or not she might be Jack the Ripper. There's this kind of sense that, you know, if she could do that to her husband and her neighbours, she could probably do anything. And there's so many rumours surrounding the mysterious deaths of previous husbands as well. So it's just that fact that she's just defying all sorts of expectations of her gender.
You know, she's not apologetic. She's not offering any sort of, you know, sad defence or anything that's, you know, a reason for why she did it. And then clearly when she goes on to commit these other crimes, I mean, she clearly has sort of serious mental health issues, but very much, you know, whenever she kills the attendant, she'd already attacked another attendant beforehand, but this attendant that she killed, it was because she didn't want her to leave her. And, you know, she was, there were sort of, I think again, that sort of fed into the portrayal of her as being this kind of worst woman. And again, yes, as Lane says, against everything that a woman should be and how she should behave.
And where was Lizzie from?
She's from some County Antrim somewhere. I mean, I'm not claiming her being in County Antrim at the minute, but we're not completely sure where exactly she's come from. And there are different, and actually one of the stories was that she'd murdered a husband in Belfast before she'd emigrated, but we're pretty sure she emigrated as a child, so I don't think she'd managed that. But that was one of the other crimes, as well as being Jack the Ripper.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive and June. Olive and June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
So tell me about some of your favorite bad Bridgets, if we can say favourite. I think it's okay. I presume when you do a research like this, you do get fond of your subjects and the information that you find out about them.
Yes, absolutely. And I also kind of feel like I get sometimes a little bit defensive too. Like if somebody tries to criticise it, you know, I'm always like, no, wait. So one of my favourites, I'm a little bit fickle, you know, I have like different favourites, different times. And I think sometimes when I'm researching somebody new as well, I'm just become so kind of obsessed by that case. But one of my favourites is a sex worker in New York, Maud Murrell. And she's working in the 1870s and she's doing very well for herself. So she has her own lavishly furnished rooms. We get really vivid descriptions of, you know, beautiful furniture, original art as well, where she is in her lodging house. She's clearly doing well because she's also attending these balls and these dances. And her sister, Charlotte, is also in New York. And both of them had been aided to New York by an uncle who had kind of funded their passage. And Charlotte is 17 and Maud is 19. And Charlotte begs Maud to leave sex work. So she's really concerned about, you know, that idea of family reputation as well. And later Maud says, you know, she will, that she will. She'll leave sex work. She'll get a job as a domestic servant, but not right now. She'll do it after Christmas. So that's a few weeks away. And that clearly shows us, that's why I like this case too, because it clearly shows us that Maud is making a calculated decision here. She's thinking about the economics involved with obviously Christmas coming up and, you know, maybe she'll have some extra payments to make. So she's also, I think, probably thinking about her negative past experience as a domestic servant. So she wasn't treated particularly well, according to the records, in some of the places where she was employed. And it's a sad ending. And we discussed that case in the podcast. But I like it because it gives us such a good insight into her daily life. You know, the dances she was attending and what her family in the US and her family at home in Cork, what they kind of thought about her.
Yeah. And would you say you're sort of fond of her or fond of the idea of her at this point and defensive of her, you said?
I'm defensive of loads of them. Yeah, I suppose I feel sympathy for her because she dies very young. And, you know, that it was precisely because of her occupation that she died. So I kind of feel like, you know, she had gone through these employments that didn't quite work for her because of these rumors about her her sexual activity. She lost those domestic servant positions and then found her way into sex work. I like her agency there too, you know, that she's making that decision. She's kind of owning it as well. And I suppose that she's doing so well for herself and that she's well connected too. You know, there's other women who are doing that same type of sex work who are obviously really close friends too.
And what about you, Leanne? Have you got a favourite Bad Bridget or favourites?
Yes, and I shoehorn her into everything we do. Eileen changes her mind quite a bit. You know,
yeah,
she
is fickle
about this. And I stick with Marion Canning, who actually was a sex worker as well. And
so both of your favourites are sex workers. I'm just going to leave that there with no comment.
And I think, as Eileen says, you do become sort of invested in their stories and you're sort of sometimes you're willing them on. And even though, you know, sometimes you feel your moral compass has got a little bit skewed that, you know, these are people who may have committed crimes and may have done wrong, but you're still, you know, you're still sometimes just hoping that you can see often the reasons why they may have ended up doing what they did. Marion Canning is, again, another story that we find out more about because of her sentence, that they reports into trying to repeal her sentence. And she's sort of 19 when we come across her in 1891 in New York. And she was a recent immigrant from County Leitrim. And she says herself that she's been working in sex work for about a year before this event took place. So and we don't really know what she'd been doing, but clearly she'd probably fallen on hard times or had difficulty getting a job, or actually saw this as a bit more lucrative than nearly like Maud in other circumstances. And the story seems to be that she met a man when she was walking home, having been out for dinner. He seemed to have commissioned her services, and then there's a dispute over paying for this, and he accuses her of taking his watch and stealing some money. And a policeman is summoned. Marion says she didn't do this. This wasn't. And actually, when she's taken to the police station, there's no money, there's no watch found on her, but she still ends up going to court for this. She's defending herself. And you can only imagine that this young, you know, recent immigrant defending herself in this New York court, even though there's absolutely no evidence that she committed this crime, it just tells us a lot about her, you know, her being a woman, her nationality, and everything about being a sex worker as well, the kind of whole lots of levels of discrimination she was up against. And she's sentenced to 7 years in prison. And where we probably we wouldn't even it wasn't even reported in the news actually at the time, but her father back in County Leitrim then writes to the judge of the of the in the case and says, you know, please, I don't know what's happened here. Please, can you, you know, don't find her guilty. Can, you know, please release her. You know, this Irish father's heart's broken. And the judge writes back and says, actually, the trial has happened. I can't do anything but write to the governor of New York. So this man back somewhere in rural Ireland is then writing to the governor of New York. And when I found these letters, I was just like, Tullian, do you think these are real? You know, is this possibly true? Could he have this written? And we do think they are. And he wrote several letters, basically, you know, saying, please, you know, please release her. I'll come and get her. I'll come to America. I'll take her home. She'll not bother you again. You know, our hearts are broken. Please let her go. And these letters do pay off. The district attorney relooks at the case. He talks to the policeman who actually wasn't there for the trial. He'd been on holiday, and he sort of says, look, the man couldn't even really recognise if it was her. I wasn't even going to arrest her. And actually, you know, he said, even though she is a sex worker, she's a more respectable, she's quite a good girl. She's more sinned against than sinning. And she is, her sentence is repealed and she's released. And then her father sort of writes and says, the governor writes obviously to tell him this has happened. And he says, well, you know, times are a bit tough and I can't actually come to America for her, but I've sent some money and I'll come and get her in Liverpool, and you know, she'll not be back. And we know that she did leave, and we know that she got married. So it's this sort of very happy ending. We're fairly sure that imagine what had happened in New York never got mentioned.
Absolutely. I'd say that was like a little veil was cast over those years. What about murder and murder cases? We mentioned, obviously, Lizzie Halliday. I mean, without trying to be sensationalist, but you did find some cases, didn't you, of Irish women who had murdered. Tell me about some of them.
Yeah, we have several cases of women who are in for attempted murder sometimes, or for violence. We have one woman, Letitia Armstrong, who's in Toronto, and she suspects that her husband and her servant are having an affair. So she pretends to go to a theatre one night, and instead she comes back a little bit early, and she catches them in bed together. And so she shoots the servant, and the servant actually loses an eye. So it's quite a severe injury. And it's, you know, there is that kind of sense that, oh, you know, the courts are saying obviously she shouldn't have done this, but there is a kind of a weird sympathy with her. And, you know, a comment is made in the court that, you know, it's surprising she didn't actually try to shoot the husband, that might have been actually a little bit more just. And, you know, those type of cases are really fascinating. We very often have far more information on those on murder cases than we have on other, you know, drunkenness or theft. But I suppose they are also they also distort the story a little bit, because they're not necessarily representative of Irish women's migration to the US, just because they're just that bit more unusual.
So after all of this, it's 5 years of research. I mean, you've spent so much time delving into it. What are your main findings, or what do you feel like you've taken from it, or helped to, you know, people to understand? Like, what is the big message here about a kind of time in emigration that we think we know a lot about, but this was stuff we didn't really know about? I mean, it really is uncovering things that had been hidden.
Yeah, I think it's kind of showing the complexities of the migration story, that it wasn't just Irish women migrated and they became nuns and teachers and servants and they got married and everything was great. I think it's showing how ordinary individuals who migrated, you know, they had these kind of struggles for survival. And just because they appear in court record once doesn't mean that they're going to have a criminal career thereafter. So I think it's important to show that kind of the poverty angle as well.
And what about you, Leanne? What's your main feeling about the work you've done and why it's valuable?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Leanne says, it does offer a much more complex and nuanced picture about emigration. And I think sometimes, particularly about Irish American emigration, there is this looking back with a very rose-tinted view that people's experiences were very positive and everybody who went did really well and achieved. And sometimes, and I think it's a good reminder to realise that that wasn't everybody's experience, and that I think perhaps if it's a prompt to say we need to think a bit more broadly about experiences of migration today, that things were difficult, that things often didn't work out well, that sometimes I think this, well, you know, we all went off and worked really hard and did really well. And this was the, you know, there's so that no, that wasn't everybody's experience. Times were tough. Also, people did things when not necessarily because times were tough, but because, you know, with complete agency and that they committed crimes. So I think it is about offering that sort of different view. And again, particularly from the female side of things, where very much the work does often focus on male immigration and male experiences. And again, as Elaine said, those very narrow views of female immigration. So it's about trying to broaden that out to a more holistic picture of what female immigration was as well.
And I suppose when you started off 5 years ago, you never thought you'd end up with a podcast. So Elaine, tell us about that. Has that been a great joy to work on, to put all your stories together? It's the perfect form for it, really. You two chatting away about these women that you've come to know.
I mean, never in a million years did I think I'd be here talking to Róisín Ingall, who I've been reading for years. So this is such a treat. It makes all those, the 5 years of, you know, being in accommodation, sitting by myself, having dry cereal, worthwhile. So, yeah, I mean, we have been taken aback, I suppose, by the interest in the podcast. I suppose it kind of it confirms our view in a way that these are stories that haven't been told, you know, that people don't actually know what happened to Irish women. And I think Irish women's voices have been silenced or overshadowed. Their lives have been overshadowed for quite a while. And so I think it is important that the women's history story is told. I mean, in terms of my relationship with Leanne, I mean, we've got to know each other quite well, I think, across 5 years. So having to speak to each other on the podcast was no task at all.
Yeah. And Leanne, did you like moving into that arena? And did you find it a great way to sort of bring the stories to life a bit for people?
Yeah, I mean, I think as Leanne says, it wasn't something 5 years ago when we were I suppose a little bit before that, when we were putting in for funding for the project, a podcast wasn't even something we vaguely considered doing. I think that when it was suggested, so when we started to do it, and we didn't really know, you know, initially we knew the sort of style that we did want to do, but, you know, it was sort of, we didn't know whether anybody other than our mums might listen to it, to be honest. So it was just sort of, we were, you know, seeing what happened. And, you know, whenever we had, you know, Siobhan McSweeney did the introductions, and we had some amazing music created for us as well. And it did all come together into something that we thought, yeah, actually, this is hopefully something people will find really interesting, that they will be able to engage with. The episodes aren't too long, and that, you know, that we'll be able to tell those stories. And we had found from some of the public talks that we'd done that people were really interested and were really engaged with it. And, you know, it was great to be able to get those stories out there and for people to hear it and for it to be accessible. Sometimes, you know, the stories can get lost in academic works, and it was good to be able to just tell those stories in that format as well.
It's been really fascinating talking to you both, and well done on your research. And I would encourage everyone to listen to the Bad Bridgets podcast, and happy St. Bridget's Day, coincidentally.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
That was Elaine Farrell and Leanne McCormack there. And the book Bad Bridget is out now, published by Penguin Sandy Cove. It really is a fantastic, important read. Do keep in touch with us on email, thewomenspodcast@irishtimes.com, and on social at IT Women's Podcast. That's it for me. The podcast is produced by Aideen Finnegan, Suzanne Brennan, and me, Róisín Ingall, with JJ Vernon on sound. We'll be back next week. Until then, mind yourselves, and I'll talk to you next time.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.